And welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society, where we strive to be an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. If this is one of your first times here or you're just visiting for the day, you'll have a space later on in the service where we will invite you, if you want to introduce yourselves. As always, we welcome you no matter where you are on the spiritual journey, the journey of life. We welcome you no matter your ethnicity, your gender identification, your sexual identity. We welcome you. The opening words were written by Rebecca Parker, and she took her inspiration for these words from Charles Hartshorne. Some of you might know that name, famous mathematician. From this line of Hartshorne's, "Be a blessing to the world." Your gifts, whatever you discover them to be, can be used to bless or curse the world. The mind's power, the strength of the hands, the reaches of the heart, the gift of speaking, listening, imagining, seeing, waiting, any of these can serve to feed the hungry, bind up wounds, welcome the stranger, praise what is sacred, do the work of justice, or offer love. Any of these can draw down the prison door, hoard bread, abandon the poor, obscure what is holy, comply with injustice, or withhold love. You must answer this question. What will you do with your gifts? Choose to bless the world. These words are a continuation of the opening words. We light this chalice to remind us that, in the words of Rebecca Parker, the choice to bless the world is more than an act of the will, a moving forward into the world with the intention to do good. It is an act of recognition, a confession of surprise, a grateful acknowledgement that in the midst of a broken world, unspeakable beauty, grace, and mystery abide. A brief reading to share with you. This is from Unitarian Universalist Minister Roger Butts, who was the minister in Davenport, Iowa, when I was the minister in Burlington, Iowa. He writes, "Sometimes life is like this. A minister friend, Meg, was invited to moderate a forum between two groups that, truth be told, would each rather that the other not exist. One side spoke and shouted. The other side spoke and shouted. Words passed like light, invasive and all-encompassing, but little understood. Exhausted, the combatants turned to Meg. Have you something to add? Meg rose. If you are in this camp, God loves you. If you are in that camp, God loves you. Then she sat down. Grace abounds. Sometimes life is like this. I once went to a meeting with my district executive in Delaware. Assuming I knew her position, I joked with her, oh yes, I'm a Unitarian Universalist Christian, but my Christology is appropriately low. What is wrong with a high Christology? She demanded. 2 weeks later, I learned that she left our place for a Catholic place. Assuming I knew her position, I forgot to hear her voice. Assuming I knew her position, I forgot to invite her into conversation. Presumption abounds. But mostly life is like this. On a Thursday afternoon, I said to one I value and trust, should we go to the water for the day? Spend some time on the bay? Yes, I think so. We drove. She sang the songs of her childhood. We watched a sunset. We heard a dog bark. The boats slowly made their way under the bridge. A Navy pilot navigated his craft. The woman at the Back Creek Inn gave us directions to a cafe where we were served wine and laughter. Life abounds. Where we were served wine and laughter. Life abounds. Life abounds, and there is all this beauty. One of the quotes at the top of your order of service says, "What do we do with this beauty?" James Baldwin asked that in his essay, "The Fire Next Time." Life abounds. Beauty abounds. We have gifts. We can use these gifts for good or evil, to bless the world or to curse the world. If you read our monthly newsletter, Prairie Fire, which I really hope you do, some of us put a lot of work into that publication, and we like to think that there is good, useful information in it. So if you read the January issue, you know that I intended to talk about connections this morning, and I asked a lot of questions in the newsletter about connections. To what or to whom are you most connected? Can true connection only happen slowly over a period of time? When connections are severed by death, distance, disagreement, what fills the vacuum? How do we connect with those with whom we disagree or do not like? Well, I'm not going to answer those questions today, at least not directly. I am instead going to take you on a different journey in the next few minutes, one in which I ask these questions. Can all this beauty eventually save us in the sense of healing our brokenness? And what will we do with our gifts? Can we use our gifts and the beauty all around us, combine those gifts with the beauty and go out into the world better prepared to turn away from ugliness and to better communicate with those with whom we disagree? Because in my preparation for today's reflections, I ended up there with beauty and gifts and their importance to all of our connections. Now, connections are the underpinning of our actions out in the world. Connections are clues to how to live. And I'm talking about connections to ourselves, to our inner selves. I'm talking about connections to each other. And I'm talking about connections to the earth. Clues point the way to what to do next, these connection clues. Clues that energize us when we are discouraged. Strong connections point the way to beauty, to a better understanding of what our gifts are and how we might use them. Here's an example from real life, from Thursday, December 29th. A Unitarian Universalist minister walks into a bar, in this case me, and in this case the Great Dane restaurant in Kildale. Yes, your minister goes to bars, well, that bar. Because I often end up there when I've either been to a movie at Hildale or am waiting to go to a movie at Hildale. So, there I was, waiting for a takeout order, having just a small one, and I was walking, not driving. And I sat down beside a man who was eating wings, and they looked so good I had to get some too. And I can tell you how many wings he ate, but I don't really know how many beers he had. Not many, I don't think. But both of us were initially reading. He was reading on his smartphone. I was reading, of course, a paper publication. But then we were bantering, you know, we were making small talk the way you do. And we laughed when somebody said something about the weather. And We both this man and I were there because of Sundance. Well, he hadn't been to his movie yet. He was going to see Fences. And this was an assignment. This man was taking classes at the University of Wisconsin here in Madison. And this was an assignment for between the semesters. And then he and I began talking about August Wilson, the playwright who wrote Fences. I don't know how many of you are familiar with either that particular play, which has now been made into a movie, or August Wilson. All of you? Most of you? Wilson happens to be African-American, black. Well, the man I was sitting beside had never heard of August Wilson, even though he was going to the movie. And so we got talking about Wilson, and I said something to the effect, well, Wilson and I grew up in the same part of the country. Wilson actually grew up in Pittsburgh. I grew up north of Pittsburgh. But then I stopped myself and I said, wait, that's not exactly true. Because I said to the man beside me, because Wilson was a black-skinned person, and me, obviously, I'm a white-skinned person. And also, August Wilson grew up in a poor part of Pittsburgh, and I grew up solidly middle class. And the man next to me and I shook our heads and made eye contact about what that meant. Did I mention that the man next to me, my new, what's that initial thing, BFF? Yeah. He has black skin. Well, it was time for him to leave, of course, for the meeting, or the movie, but he was meeting his 16-year-old son to go to this. So I'm still sitting on the bar stool, and my new friend came over, and we had another few moments about teenagers, what it's like living with teenagers and raising teenagers. And then he gave me a hug, and it wasn't predatory or you know, it was just natural. It was wonderful. And I said, "Be careful out there." And you know, he said, "Yeah." And I said, "And tell your son, your 16-year-old son, to be careful out there." And my new best friend stopped and said, "Well, I try to, but you know, he's a teenager, and I know nothing." Also, my new best friend, yes, he had black skin. He also had a hoodie on. Connections, assumptions. What is really goes on out there, outside these walls. I'm not going to get too much into this little story. I'll save it for later. But had I had a hoodie on and had my skin color been different, a couple of years ago at Grand Canyon, I might not be up here talking. I might be dead. I might have been shot because a park ranger was about to put me in handcuffs. And it's a long, silly story. But I reached into my pocket to get my ID. "Get your hand out of your pocket, put your hands up!" She thought I had a gun. Do I look like a man? Anyway. Enough of all that, but think about that, assumptions. I went astray in preparing for this morning, if we want to call it that, when I ran across that Baldwin quote in an essay by Parker, Rebecca Parker. I've spoken of Rebecca Parker before. She was president of Star King School for the Ministry when I was there. She is both a Methodist minister and a Unitarian Universalist minister, and she is one of the most noted theologians of our time. I was lucky to be at Star King when she was there. She's now retired. So she wrote an essay. So we have the Baldwin essay, The Fire Next Time, but then Rebecca Parker wrote an essay titled, What Shall We Do With All This Beauty? Using, of course, the quote from Baldwin. I don't know how many of you have read The Fire Next Time. Yeah, I think it was required reading for me somewhere along the way. I need to reread it. In that essay, Baldwin writes about the experience of people of African descent in this culture. It's not a pretty picture. Baldwin grew up in the ghettos of New York City. And Rebecca Parker's words. Baldwin writes about how the sense of the sacredness of other human beings gets lost in places like that, how relationships and connections are broken. But at the end of that essay, to think that he arrived at beauty, after talking about all of this terrible stuff he lived through in the ghettos, I find that astonishing. Then in her essay, What Shall We Do With All This Beauty?, Parker gives me another astonishing quote. Here it is. The greatest challenge in our lives is the challenge presented to us by the beauty of life. The greatest challenge in our lives is the challenge presented to us by the beauty of life, by what beauty asks of us, and by what we must do to keep faith with the beauty that has nourished our lives. And then Parker says, in response to James Baldwin's question, what shall we do with all this beauty? Parker says, this question is important because we are living in an ugly time. Okay, here's an Ingham quote. The times just got uglier, much uglier. We have lost our way in this country. We are becoming not only loosely connected in so many ways, but also disconnected in so many ways. You'll never believe when Parker wrote this. 1997, 20 years ago. Let's do a little putting things in context here. There was a policy position called, this was introduced into the House of Representatives in 1994, Contract with America. Many of you will remember it. Some of us called it the Contract on America.
Yeah.
Jim Forbes, then the minister of Riverside Church in New York City, said, someone has forged God's signature on the contract with America. That policy, for those of you who don't remember, was ugly. It demanded the worst of us. That document put the blame for everything that wasn't right in this country on the most vulnerable and the least powerful in our country by calling for locking up more people, keeping immigrants out, taking away safety nets for the poor, silencing artists, chipping away at women's rights. And here we go again. 20 years ago. Here we go again. Only this time it seems to me that it is going to be much worse. This time there aren't any controls on the extreme right. This time there are no checks and balances. This time we have a crazy person calling the shots, a man who only cares about himself and about getting lots of attention. A person who has legitimized hate, yes, I've said that before to you up here, but also someone who is encouraging exclusivity, not connection. Now there are a lot of reasons for disconnection, not just the rise of the political and religious right, but I don't have time this morning to get into them. I'll just say a couple of provocative things. I think that one of the reasons that we're more disconnected than ever is the assault on public schools, and I think that homeschooling has a lot to do with that. An argument could also be made that we are disconnected even more than ever because of the demise of journalism, real journalism, and the rise of fake news. That's kind of oxymoron, but anyway. I also think, and I have read this is not an original thought, that our disconnection also comes from the way we live now in such areas as we don't have front porches anymore. Mm-hmm. Air conditioning. Nobody goes outside anymore because we have air conditioning. And we mustn't ever forget television. Now, there are three things that we can do. And we don't have time to get into them in great depth, but I'll be returning to them during the year. Happy New Year, by the way. These are kind of three New Year's resolutions. You could think of them that way. And they come from Rebecca Parker. The first one is that we have to practice being prophetic witnesses. Now, she doesn't mean prophets in the sense that you might think of right away when you hear that word, prophets. Rebecca Parker and I mean, try to think of a prophet as someone who can look at a situation, a life, a country, policies, and see what the rest of us are resisting seeing. Now, some of us do this already in different ways. I mean, I know lots of us have called out the climate deniers and said, what? No, the majority of scientists say this is happening. But this exercising our prophetic witness is tied in with something I've talked to you about, that we're numb. Hannah Arendt said this not originally, but she wanted to be, were numb to what's really going on. Because for a number of reasons. It seems too overwhelming. I mean, Syrian refugees, yes, they want to do something, but what can I do? That kind of thing. Numbness is a denial, of course, of what is actually happening. Anna Arendt called it non-thinking. We have to look at the pain, the grief, the sorrow, the frustration, the anger, all those so-called dark, negative emotions. We have to look at them face to face. We have to say, there they are. Okay. Then you go through that and hopefully come out at the other end transformed with new ideas and new visions. How many of you have followed the controversy, one of the controversies going on at the UW-Madison around the supposed controversial, non-elective class, problem with whiteness? Yeah. I mean, excuse me. Don't give me some. But you have to look at this. There is a problem with whiteness. I mean, it's not a problem with whiteness. I can't help that I'm white. But there is a problem with the way we, white people, have presented ourselves in the world. There's a problem with the dominant culture. The only way we are going to be able to do backlash against the backlash in this country, the only way is to look at the pain, to recognize our pain and our grief. So I cry every morning. I cry almost every morning, partly because I'm a news junkie and I can't quite stay away from news. But okay, I have to sort of decide, all right, that's okay. It's okay to cry about what's going on. It's probably a good thing if we're following what I'm saying now. So, okay, that's that. But I don't think we'll ever, I used to think that history was linear. But now I'm beginning to think it's circular because there we were. 20 years ago, and 20 years before that, and 20 years before that, and we're still fighting the same battles, and it's like, where are we? Did we fall down the rabbit hole? Yes, we did. But how do you break it? How do you break the circle? I think we break it by being prophetic witnesses and the two other things that Rebecca Parker calls us to do. The second one is that we need to strive to preserve what she calls endangered knowledge. We know about love and grace and forgiveness and hope and possibility. We know all these things. And in some ways, everybody who gets up here on a Sunday morning is talking about that in different ways. But I don't think we trust those things. I don't think that progressives and liberals and free thinkers really believe that those things can change the world? I don't think we're tough enough. I think we have to do more speaking up kindly, but bluntly, and maybe not always kindly. What would you say is the dominant religion in the world, or the dominant religious force? I'll bet a lot of you would answer the religious right. Theologian John Cobb would say that our current economic system is the dominant religion of the world. And he has a lot of scholarship and statistics to back this up. Global capitalism. Please note that I did not say global markets. Global capitalism. It causes relationships, connections to break down. It makes us humans feel that we are only worth something if we continue to consume and if we go about doing whatever we're doing without thinking about anything. The dominant culture is still resisting true connection, true freedom for the oppressed, true justice for all, environmental stewardship. Think about global capitalism in terms of oil wells in Nigeria, coal mining in Appalachia, toxic waste in streams, rivers, oceans, Love Canal, Flint, Michigan, Standing Rock. Try to take a break from that sometimes. Parker says take a Sabbath break. Now, I know that those of you with children at home can't really take a break for an entire day, but if you could try to find 10 minutes to think about, to step back and ponder what knowledge is endangered. What are we losing? Parker says that going to observing the Sabbath and gathering in gatherings like this is a radical act of resistance to a culture that has lost track of the meaning of life. So think about that. You are right now engaging in a radical act of resistance. So good for you. And you did it on a really, really cold morning. Dragged yourselves here. The third task for people of faith who are exploring alternative ways of being in the world is this. Learn to endure the shamanistic journey. Learning to endure the shamanistic journey is our other great religious task. Now, and whenever I use the word religious, please remember I'm using it in the best and broadest sense of the word, so that it encompasses all who are in this room, atheists and theists and everyone else. So you're hearing this, okay, endure the shamanistic journey, and you're probably going, what? Say what? Rebecca Parker, whom I dearly love, and she's an incredible wordsmith, but often her words need some picking apart and study and interpretation. A shaman, the part of the derivation of that word comes from a word for Buddhist monk. A shaman is a priest doctor who uses magic to cure the sick and to heal the broken. The magic is that we try to recognize what is really going on. Like Penny's cell phone is now ringing. So there we all turn and look at Penny. But the shamanistic journey is one in which we come full circle and try to turn ugliness to beauty, hate to love, loose connections to lasting, meaningful connections. Some of you will remember that on Christmas morning, which was also Hanukkah, I read a reading that ended with, light the lamp, even though there's no oil. It's the message of Hanukkah. It's the message of Christmas. It's the message of hope and possibility. That's what we try to do on the shamanistic journey. Light the candle, even though there isn't any oil. In 1993, at General Assembly, I'm just going to leave you with these two last stories. They're short. 1993, General Assembly, Charlotte, North Carolina, which is in the Thomas Jefferson District. It hosted the Thomas Jefferson Ball. I don't know if anybody was there. I was there. Inviting people to come dressed in period costumes. African Americans asked, shall we come wearing chains? Whites found themselves asking, how could we have been so unthinking? How did we fail to remember that Jefferson owned slaves? We learned a lot that General Assembly. We learned about recognizing the power of prophetic witness. We learned a lot about keeping endangered knowledge alive. We learned a lot about being shamans and making magic happen to heal the world. There's a good argument to be made for not changing the name of that district, though. They did explore that after that General Assembly, and taking the Thomas Jefferson name away. That is not how we face the pain of the past and the grief of the past. Nobody's perfect. It wasn't changed. I'm glad it wasn't changed. And then this. I was, or I am reading a book by Russell Banks. I've never read him, and I've always wanted to. And he lives in Appalachian. The Adirondacks. I think he still lives up there in North State, New York. So a lot of his books are set, I think he may have grown up in Buffalo, but a lot of his books are set in upstate New York. And I was a minister in Plattsburgh, New York, which is at one end of the Adirondacks. So I know what he's talking about. It's a fiction. It's actually a mystery. which I he's never done another mystery. But, so here I am this past week reading this, which had I didn't think anything to do with my preparation for this morning. You know, it was rest your brain reading. Okay, so the main character flies an airplane. It's 1937. It's a biplane and a pontoon. And he happens to be up in the air over a lake. I know this lake in the Adirondacks, and it's beautiful. It's a perfect day for flying. And he says that. Oh, it's a perfect day for flying. And he banks around to go the other way, and there, right in front of him, is the Hindenburg. Which, this could have been true, because that is the route the Hindenburg took in this country, through New Jersey and then down somewhere. And this guy happens to be an artist, the pilot, the main character. And he's like, whoa! You know, he's always wanted to see the Hindenburg, but kept missing it when it flew over where he lives. And so he's flying around it, and it's gigantic. I mean, I'm sure the description of the Hindenburg is accurate. I can't believe how big it was. He flies the length of it, and he's like, whoa, what an experience. Can I paint this? Oh, I hope I can paint this. And he goes around, and I'm going to read what he wrote. Toward the aft of the airship, where the hull narrowed slightly, four gigantic fins emerged, a dorsal fin and a fin on either side, and a keel-like fin from the belly. And as Jordan, the pilot, flew past them, he saw, now remember, he's immersed in all this beauty. He flies past these fins, and he saw the enormous red and black swastikas emblazoned on the fins. He had not expected that. At once, the Zeppelin lost all its beauty. It became an ugly thing. He peeled sharply away from the airship, cut speed, and so on. Oof. That's what I mean when I'm talking about ugly. He went from beauty to ugly in that incident. But it is up to us to find the beauty and to use the gifts we have been given for the benefit of all, not just for a chosen few. Here's the last part of Rebecca's Parker's words that I used for the, it's actually the middle part because I'm going to use some for closing words. There is an embrace of kindness, she writes. There is an embrace of kindness that encompasses all life, even yours. And while there is injustice, anesthetization, or evil, there moves a holy disturbance, a benevolent rage, love that, a benevolent rage, a revolutionary love, protesting, urging, insisting, that which is sacred will not be defiled. Those who bless the world live their life as a gesture of thanks for this beauty and this rage. And to complete Rebecca Parker's benediction, the choice to bless the world can take you into solitude to search for the sources of power and grace, native wisdom, healing, and liberation. More, the choice will draw you into community. The endeavor shared, the heritage passed on, the companionship of struggle, the importance of keeping faith, the life of ritual and praise, the comfort of human friendship, the company of earth, its chorus of life welcoming you. None of us alone can save the world. Together, that is another possibility. Waiting. If you want to see beauty, as you greet your neighbor, just really look at them. Look into their eyes and their faces. That is beauty. Go in peace. Drink coffee. Buy bread.
Oh, bye.
Buy bread.
Buy bread.
And goodies. And I know many of you are going to meetings, so go to meetings.